This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 30 of What's It Like. My guest is Steve Blank, who is probably best known for startups.
Hey, Ken.
So how do you start a startup?
You start a startup about one of 500 different ways. You could have the idea as a founder, and it could be something that you've just wanted to do forever. It could be something that somebody walked into your office or room and described their idea, and you kind of said, hey, I want to do that. That's exciting. Or you and a couple friends could be brainstorming ideas. And so there's no one way to start a company. But in the sum of all those is really that startups are an act of creation. They're very different than a day job, which is traditionally an act of or series of acts of execution. Startups are very different than that, which is why most people who work in companies actually find it uncomfortable or hard to do.
Mm-hmm. How did you start? You didn't begin businesses as a child, I don't suppose. Or did you?
No, not even a lemonade stand. It's just a complete accident.
So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in New York City.
So you're a long way from home.
Long way from anything any relatives, friends, family ever knew or understood. In fact, I did startups for 20 years, and wasn't until I retired and actually started teaching at Berkeley and Stanford that my mother finally said, oh, now I understand what you do.
I thought you were going to say, she said, now you have a job.
Well, she said that too, but I thought the most interesting part was, now I understand what you do.
How did your parents influence you? How did they impact your worldview?
On one level, they were, small businesses. When I was young, I had a grocery store on the Lower East Side of New York, a typical immigrant experience. And as I was older, they got divorced, and my father abandoned the family, and my mother essentially, left me to raise myself. So I think the influences were not the traditional, growing up in a business family influences.
Mm-hmm. What about your childhood? What was the biggest challenge?
I never did any homework in my life. I swear, I didn't even know what homework was. So watching my kids grow up and making them do their homework, thank God I had a wife who had a normal childhood. So I just liked to read a lot, but I was a horrible student. And in hindsight, it was basically because I was just in survival mm-hmm. mode at home. I had no attention at all for class. So, I graduated high school out of sympathy rather than grade.
What did you do after high school?
By accident, which was kind of surprising to me and certainly my classmates. I was in a New York City high school that had 1,000 students in its graduating class. And, there was always the top 20 kids you knew who were the smart kids in the school. And, they took all the advanced classes. And New York City at the time, I don't know if they still did, had something called the Regents Scholarship, which was essentially a scholarship you won by exams. So they posted the results of exams. And, if you were in the top, 10, you won a scholarship. And everybody crowds around looking for their scores. And, I started at the bottom looking up. And I must have been there for about a half hour. And turned out of 1,000 students, I was third. It was the first inkling that, I might have, a couple of neurons that were firing that even I didn't know. So make a long story short, I got a scholarship to Michigan State University. Ended up going there as a pre-med, which was the kind of, this is what you did if you were an immigrant. So, mm-hmm. And dropped out of a semester. I had a girlfriend who looked at me and said, most of us, are working hard to stay here. You don't even look like you like it here. And she was right. And I first realized that I now had permission to start living my life rather than my parents. And I dropped out, and it was middle of a Michigan winter, and stuck out my thumb and hitchhiked to Miami. And after a series of adventures, ended up working at the Miami International Airport, loading racehorses onto cargo planes. When the racing season was over, they shipped them back up north, and, when the other season, they flew them back the other way. and hated the horses, but fell in love with airplanes. And actually, specifically, not the pilots and not even the planes, but all the equipment on it, all the radar and navigation equipment and the rest. But I realized I would never get a chance to work on it unless I had an education.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, we were in the middle of the Vietnam War, and another long story, I ended up volunteering for the military and joining the Air Force in the middle of Vietnam. More adventures, thought I was going to be in electronics repairing computers as the recruiter promised me as an 18-year-old. Found myself being assigned. In fact, well, it was electronics, but it was something called electronic warfare, which by accident happened to be the field that was constantly advancing because the North Vietnamese were shooting at our airplanes, and this was the equipment that supposedly protected them. And I ended up volunteering to go to Southeast Asia and spent a year and a half on multiple air bases in Thailand, learning and teaching and mostly repairing electronics equipment, which is how I learned electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Military had a great, essentially a vocational technical school, and that was actually what I needed because I found my passion in that school and found that I was quite good at, in hindsight, troubleshooting. Was really not fixing a technical problem. It was actually understanding, the big picture of all the possible faults and logically reducing what could be the most likely problem without going through they gave you massive technical manuals, but what I discovered intuitively that there was just very quick ways to analyze and fix problems if you understood the system, which would kind of last me my whole life and career. So I spent 4 years in the Air Force and then got out and tried to go back to school, which I did at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and went back this time as a double E and electrical engineer. And I still remember collecting unemployment, being on college work study, and getting the GI Bill. I don't think I made much more money for another 5 years. And by accident, my college work study job was in the physics department, and after a week or two fixing equipment that they hadn't seen working in years, someone said, "You asked me how to do this." I said, "Yeah." They said, "Well, how'd you like to work on the nuclear reactor?" I went, "What?" Universities have nuclear reactors. Turns out in the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. government and the Atoms for Peace program put research reactors in about 150 universities in and outside the U.S. And this University of Michigan had one, and they had the original SCRAM system or safety system built out of vacuum tubes, and they wanted somebody to rebuild it based on, an improved design out of transistors. And so I did that, and I spent almost a decade worrying if I wired it correctly until I found out 5 years ago they actually shut down the reactor, so now I'm safe.
So when did you discover that you're smart?
I think standing in front of that Regent Scholarship listing in literally the last month or two of high school, when and my sister, who had left home when she was 16, had always said, "Listen, you're wired differently. You're pretty smart." I just never believed her because all available evidence at the time, grades, friends, et cetera, I hung out with the dumb kids who, are now, I'm sure, janitors or slicing deli meat somewhere, which I think actually they are. That was my peer group. And again, in hindsight, it was because I was probably processing 120% of my neurons on just surviving as a, as in a latchkey kid would kind of be a polite description. I kind of now in hindsight realize I was probably living in an outpatient clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't much time to be thinking about other stuff. But in the military, I really got to blossom. I mean, it turns out the U.S. military, and we're seeing it again in Afghanistan and Iraq, happens to be an organization which is incredibly bureaucratic. I mean, the definition of it in peacetime, but in wartime, what we do wonderfully well is we innovate and we promote creativity. And so as a 19-year-old, I was managing 20 people and realized I had a skill which, as I said, lasted me my whole life. And it also brought out a couple other things I now understand. I turned into heuristics. One is all the conventional wisdom of never volunteer for anything. I volunteered for everything. I mean, that's how I ended up overseas. That's how I ended up managing people. That's how, you know, all my other friends, hey, let's go downtown, go get drunk or other stuff. And I'd go, well, yeah, I'll meet you there later, but I'm going to volunteer to help over here. Why should you do that? And, you know, that was the other part. It's not only volunteering, but the other thing I learned, again, implicitly, is show up a lot. I would just show up a lot where other people go, okay, job's over. What I'd volunteer to do other things, not because I was trying to be good or kiss ass. I mean, that never even entered in the calculus. It's because I was interested, and that's the third piece. I was just always curious. I mean, my job didn't end at my job, even if my job didn't include, you know, this part of the equipment. I was always interested in learning it and learning something else. And so to me, showing up a lot, volunteering, and intense curiosity kind of drove my entire career. And those were skills that could be learned. I mean, there's nothing in here about being intelligent. It was just none of that was conventional wisdom. Well, military, your first thing you learn is don't volunteer for anything. Show up a lot. Who teaches you that? And show up a lot, I just mean, it's not to, you know, whether the boss sees you. It's just put yourself in places where opportunities you can't even predict will happen. And then be curious. It's just, you know, I went from industry to industry just because I was always interested in how does this work, or is there a better way to do this, or, gee, have somebody thought about this, or, gee, I'd like to learn about this. So that's just generic advice. It turns out, personally, the skill I kind of brought in general, which was kind of unique, but I also believe could be taught, was pattern recognition. Meaning, you know, I'm always gathering a lot of data, and I don't know what goes on in the back of my mind, but, you know, disconnected pieces of information somehow connect themselves in new patterns, and I tend to see things. And so most of the, you know, it's there's a fine line between being a visionary and hallucinating. And, you know, most of the time it's not clear. Only time will tell. But that brings up probably the fourth point, which, again, is not a skill. It's just something that you could do. And that is don't be afraid to challenge the status quo. That is, if you do see something that others see, you know, the standard in any company or organization is, well, that can't be right. Or you know, the classic, well, we've always done it this way. Okay, well, you could go back to work and ignore it, or you could say, no, I'm right, and just be not obnoxious, but incredibly persistent about it. My career has great examples of that. I came up with this thing called customer development, which is a new way to think about and teach entrepreneurship. You know, everybody laughed. Yeah. Well, Steve, you know, we've been venture capitalists for 30 years. This is how we've always done it. We make a ton of money. Yeah, but I don't think you guys are right. Steve, we're a great entrepreneur. Now, this is how we do our business. Now, it's taken 10 years, but the entire venture capital community is kind of now, and entrepreneurs, now kind of do startups more in the way I've been talking about than the way they used to, because they've realized that there is a more efficient and more interesting way to build companies.
You said you're retired, but what exactly do you do?
Well, you know, I now do what I call drive-by teaching. I'm a lecturer at Stanford University in the engineering school, and I also lecture at UC Berkeley in the Haas Business School, and then also lecture in a joint MBA with Berkeley and Columbia Business School in New York. So I do that. And then I used to sit on technology boards of directors, but I got off of all those, and I now mostly do nonprofit work. On boards, mostly around conservation and the environment. Mm. And then I'm also a public official in the state of California.
What are you public official of?
It turns out there's a state agency called the California Coastal Commission.
Oh, yes.
Which is kind of the land planning agency for the entire state. And there's a staff of about 120 to 140, depending on their budget, and who are staff employees. And then who make recommendations to a set of commissioners, 12 of them, who are political appointees, and I'm one of the 12 coastal commissioners.
Uh-huh.
You know, the commissioners are pretty independent, and I think they all take their jobs pretty seriously. It's essentially that there's some pristine parts of the California coast, that, not by accident. If you drive north of Santa Barbara, you drive San Mateo County outside of Silicon Valley, Marin, Sonoma, you know, these places don't look like that by accident.
Yes.
California has obviously some of the most overbuilt coastlines in the world, but also stretches that are next to urban areas. They're just unbelievably pristine because of something the people of the state did about 30 years ago, and that is they passed something called the Coastal Act, which in its preamble has something I don't think anybody's like really spent time thinking about. It says the coast of California is a shared resource for all Californians. Does it mean it's not just yours or mine? It means it's everyone's.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an amazing thing to put in a preamble for a planning document. And then all the authority and power derives from that Coastal Act. But that is that's kind of right up there.
It's kind of shocking to go from a very urban area to these beautiful stretches of beach. But what great fun.
Yeah, and you know what great forethought the legislature and the people of California had 30 years mm-hmm. ago.
In all the things you do, what's the best thing about your job?
Well, you know, this is like my third or fourth career. You know, I had a military career for 4 years, and maybe a little more extension of it. My first company here in Silicon Valley was in military intelligence, so maybe 6-7 years. Then I was an entrepreneur, career two as a joining and then being part of and then starting my own companies, and that lasted 20 years. And then as a teacher, that was a third career. I still do that. And I, you know, by now I've had over 1,000 students. And then as a public official, you know, that's a, I'm now in my fifth year as a public official in California. And so, you know, the last two has been as interesting as the first two. But each one has been different, and, you know, each one has just almost been different lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I've, you know, I guess that kind of falls into the show up a lot, forever curious, you know, volunteer for everything type of thing. You know, and by the way, all this was done without a college degree. You know, I dropped out of Michigan the second time because I still didn't have the attention this time. It was just like having come back from Southeast Asia in a war. You know, going to school seemed like the most boring thing I could have ever done. And in hindsight, I'm sure, and I know I missed a lot since I now teach at three major universities, but, you know, it was the right thing for me.
Mm-hmm. So how has entrepreneurship changed over the years?
Oh, geez. I guess probably the biggest change, one I had nothing to do with, is we went from, as an entrepreneur, information scarcity to information overload. And then we went from entrepreneurship as a unknown, bizarre thing to do to now it's part of the culture. So first, when I came out to Silicon Valley, you know, no one even knew what Silicon Valley was. I didn't even know one had heard of it. And two is when you were out here as an entrepreneur, there was no information. I mean, it was basically coffees with your friends or other experienced entrepreneurs. And one of the nice things about the culture was people loved to share and pay it forward in terms of helping others. And that's still part of the culture here. But there was no internet. There was no books on it. There was no nothing. So you learned by word of mouth. Nowadays, my students suffer from too much information, meaning there's a blog with an opinion that, you know, not 180 degrees different. There are 360 opinions for each degree and, you know, difference. And so what I try to teach them is a methodology for sorting through all this information. If you don't have any core beliefs or core strategies, then everything sounds like it's correct. And so you really need to develop some kind of methodology to sort through that. So that's change one. Change two is, as I said, you know, entrepreneurship was something that crazy people did.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's kind of the cool thing to do. And mm-hmm. I, by the way, I think that's a mistake. You know, entrepreneurship, every once in a while I get, not every once in a while, almost every quarter, I get students, particularly from business school, say, Professor Blank, I need some career advice. Well, what is it? Well, I'm trying to decide between two jobs. Great. What are they? I've been offered this great job at McKinsey. Wonderful. McKinsey's a great firm. Well, what's the other choice you have? Oh, my roommates are thinking of doing a startup, and I'm thinking of joining them. And they're always, well, you decided. They said, well, you haven't heard the idea. I said, no, you decided. Well, how have I decided? I said, you can't have McKinsey and a startup in the same sentence. McKinsey's a job. A startup is a passion. Startup's not a job. The confusion is that the culture has made it something that seems exciting. But joining a startup has to be something that you're willing to jettison friends, family, sleep, you know, any other interest, and just get deeply involved. You don't get to go home from a startup. You get to go home from a job.
Mm-hmm. Can you have a startup if you're old?
Sure. Though I think there is enough evidence to say that there are some types of startups, particularly internet startups, that are best done when you're young, because the technology is changing so rapidly. So if I was looking at whether to think about the probabilities of some 23-year-old, or think about 100 startups, so 23-year-olds in web-based internet startups versus 100 started by 60-year-olds, I'd probably bet on the 100 23-year-olds, not any particular, but just over time, because the delta rate, not just the rate of change, but the delta rate of change is just enormous. And in fact, in that pile, experience is a burden, not a help. There are other market segments where that's just inverted, where, in fact, experience and wisdom actually do matter. So I think having this age and ageism argument really isn't granular enough. There are some where you could just logically make the case that it's not about an individual, it's about a group. About a group of 100, which one would you rather have working on the problem?
Mm-hmm.
The second is, and I'll just observe it in myself, and I think I've seen it generalized, is that when you're young, meaning in your 20s, you're just too stupid to know it can't be done. don't laugh. It's not a joke. Is that when you're old?
I was remembering.
Yeah, you when you're old, you know more, and therefore you think that no is a certainty. And the best experiment in that is that most Nobel Prizes are given for work done by people in their early 20s. Don't look at the age that they received the prize. What you want to calculate is the age in which they actually were doing the work. Most of them win it in their early 20s. Again, I don't think it means that every individual who crosses 30 or 40 or 50 isn't creative. I think my best work has been done in the last 3 or 4 years. But I think if you just put 100 of me in the room versus 100 20 or 30-year-olds working on something, I'm not sure which group I'd bet on.
I have more questions for Steve Blank right after I remind you of the good work being done by St. Jude's. This is a great place that helps lots of children, and you can help them. Go to stjude.org, click on the donate button. It costs over $1 million a day to operate St. Jude's. Your contribution with others makes it possible to help kids who otherwise would have no hope. So please, chip in. Go to stjude.org. I also added St. Jude's to my Facebook page. After all, how could you not like St. Jude's? So, Steve, everyone has to give themselves self-motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
You know, that's a great question. I guess my entire life I've been self-motivated is the wrong word because I never would have used the word motivated. I would have used the word curious. I'm just forever interested in things, you know, like outside, quote, my department, you know, or my job spec. Always interested. And I think, you know, I've kind of concluded that genetically we kind of selected for people like me not being the main part of the tribe, but there was always one member of the tribe when we were probably hunting on the savannah, you know, for the last couple hundred thousand years, there was always one guy that genetically would be interested in what was over the next hill. And most of the time, he wouldn't come back because he'd get eaten, because it was pretty good at, in this valley. But every once in a while, that individual would come back and say, hey, there's more buffalo over here. And the tribe would move. But most of the tribe would be more than happy just hunting or farming wherever they were. It was just great. I think, that's almost an entrepreneurship selection. I think my brain is just kind of wired for, it's not that I need to overthrow the status quo, but I'm just always interested in what's next. And maybe that's just motivation. Let me be clear. I've never had a career plan. I had no idea. Not only I would have four major careers, but that even when I was doing startups, what the next one would be. I mean, I did two semiconductor companies, a supercomputer company, a video game company, an enterprise software company, never once thinking I was an expert in any of them. In fact, if you look through my history, you would have said, no, gee, you're a semiconductor guy. And I would never think of myself as someone who was an expert in starting chip companies. I just happened to be there.
Let me turn the question around. How do you calm yourself when you have to soothe yourself?
I read and I hike. We now live in a kind of a pretty tranquil part of the California coast, part that still has lots of bobcat hunt and coyotes hunt on the front lawn. And, and then when we need to, we drive over to Silicon Valley. So reading and kind of contemplating and connecting with nature is kind of what just recharges my battery.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Having two children is always a challenge. Particularly because I had no role models for what good parenting looked like. Luckily I married a woman and still married the same woman who just a wonderful mother and wife who had great instincts and grew up well. And, they would smack me in the head and say, no, you're supposed to talk to them or you're supposed to read them story. Really? Is that what you're saying? Okay. And I've always just enjoyed having my kids around. I think that was kind of a basic heuristic I decided, and it turned out that they were enjoyable to have around. But, like all kids, they've had challenges both, growing up and health issues, et cetera. And, that having a family always adds perspective and brings your core values front and center.
That's true. If you're giving a commencement speech for high school or college, what would you give as your best advice? What would you say?
I just did a commencement speech, actually. So thank you for asking.
Sure.
I started with, even though you just got your degree, no one in the world really gives a damn about your grades or how popular you were or what teams you were on. It's now your turn. It's about you showing up. It's about volunteering. It's about being creative and figuring out what's over the next hill. Just enjoy it, because there's no undo button.
I want to thank Steve Blank for joining me. Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.